This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Have you ever had your eye on an old, dilapidated building and thought to yourself, man, I'd love to get my hands on that and fix it up? Well, it's actually happening all over Cincinnati and northern Kentucky's urban areas. Sometimes the projects are small, and sometimes they are big and controversial. One instance is the fight over the preservation of the Terrace Plaza Hotel in downtown Cincinnati. So let's talk about these issues and more with Cincinnati Preservation Association Executive Director Paul Muller. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
And Mansion Hill Properties Developer and Newport Business Association President Mark Rambler. Welcome, Mark.
Welcome. Thank you.
If you have questions about historic preservation or the Terrace Plaza Hotel or other issues related to that topic, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. Paul, I want to start with you because I just want a brief overview on this hotel situation downtown. It seems like there's a lot going on with it. An effort to redevelop it, a nuisance lawsuit against it by the city. Just give us the latest. What's the deal with it?
Sure. First of all, council member David Mann has put forward a request for landmark designation. So that's one track that's happening. The city's enforcing its code and nuisance ordinances, which we're very happy about. You know, people need to take care of their buildings. So these are really separate tracks. The landmark designation is really important because in Cincinnati, you know, we take care and celebrate our landmarks. Memorial Hall, Music Hall, Union Terminal, Carew Tower, all of those represent sort of a different decade. And the Terrace Plaza put Cincinnati on the map in 1948. I mean, what a lot of people in Cincinnati don't realize is it burst onto the scene. It was in Time, Life, News, I don't think Newsweek existed, but it was covered nationally because it was the first modern hotel in the country. It was sort of the country returning from war to civilian production, and it celebrated the new.
Well, it's interesting that you say that at that point it was a modern addition to the hotel scene, and now we're looking at it from a historic perspective because, you know, 1948 was 70 years ago. What was so exciting about it then? What made it modern?
Well, first of all, it was a mixed-use building. They were kind of looking at the future. It had the two department stores in the block, retail on the street, and then the hotel lobby was on the eighth floor. They incorporated modern art into the design for the very first time. So the public, which hadn't really got to experience art, you'd see Miro, Calder, and then the Saul Steinberg mural depicting Cincinnati. It was an integration of the sort of view of modernism. And it was done by a young woman architect by the time who had her birthday yesterday. Natalie Dubois would have been 98 years old yesterday. And I just learned she was 24 years old when she designed it.
Wow.
And she had to fight for it. There are some great oral histories about it, and it was actually her design.
So what are the plans for the site currently?
Well, the owner, I believe, is working with Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, the original architects of the Paris Terrace Plaza. They're working on some designs that will be presented, I think, this week or next. And GBBN is also working on the hotel tower part. So they have good professionals working on it. We're still waiting to see if it's going to be redeveloped with its history as part of the theme. And that's what it looks like is happening. There were other proposals that stripped the building of its history, and that's why we need the landmark designation.
So what does it mean to retain the history within it? What are the elements that you're most concerned about?
Well, there is the facade, which looks a little ungainly to people. And it's been, you know, modernism already has a problem because people don't think of it as old to begin with. But it is really packed with cultural significance in people's lives. And there was more glass on that block than we see right now. The brick was extended down another floor. So keeping the skin of the building and redeveloping the public spaces, like the gourmet room and the seventh floor lobby, which is in actually pretty good shape. It has all of its wonderful marble and stainless steel.
Mark Rambler, you've had your hands in historic preservation for about as long as you've been alive, it seems like. And you literally, I'm going to give you a chance to plug your old hometown in Campbell County because you literally wrote the book.
I did.
On the preservation of a little place called Camp Springs, a little hamlet in Campbell County. For people who don't know about Camp Springs first, let's just start with that. Tell them what it is. And I mean, it's such a cool place to just see.
So how much time do we have today?
You have 30 seconds for this part.
Okay. Camp Springs is like kind of a little community that the world forgot. It was settled in like the 1840s, 50s, 60s. These wonderful stone-built homes by Germans, like built into the hillsides, kind of looked like they were plucked right from Germany and put into the hillsides of Camp Springs.
It's like something out of a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And you got to grow up there.
I did. I grew up there. Our family's actually been there for about 150 years, 160 years. So there's 27 properties that are individually listed on the National Register there, and they're extremely significant.
But now you live in the big city of Newport. You've got your hands in a lot of projects there. But first, I'd like you to weigh in on issues like the Terrace Plaza Hotel. Why is it important to preserve these urban core historic structures?
Oh, wow. So I think that the Terrace is an extremely important modernist building, and it actually had kind of a short life how it was designed because it was renovated a lot in the 1960s. So it only had about 20 years where it was just really streamlined, modern, awesome building. And I hope that that's what they take it back to. But, you know, it's hard to quantify why preservation is important and why it's important to save
But there is data that sometimes argues in support of preserving buildings, that it is good for the economy to do that in some respect. Can either of you explain that?
It used to be that there would be an argument, preservation or economic development. It's totally flipped now. Preservation is economic development. As a matter of fact, it's one of the most powerful tools that cities have at their disposal. The cities that are really prospering and growing around the country are ones that have a sense of authenticity and vitality, and they resonate with people. We're so lucky in Cincinnati because we have so much more of it than many cities. And we don't have to make that argument anymore. Capitalism is a kind of funny thing. They're all coming forward. Preservation is a redevelopment strategy that is proven. And in Cincinnati, it's almost like a switch flipped with the whole community a few years ago. I think reopening Washington Park was one. But it's sort of accepted. And even not just economics, but even neuroscience is starting to show that the way the human brain interacts with its environment is how it's how we shape ourselves. And there's fascinating research coming out that architects and planners are using. Because the richness of the places you are, the amount of memories, we're constantly recreating ourselves in relation to our environment. Preservation can play a really wonderful role in that.
Well, it's true that a lot of modern planning concepts have to do with, I mean, for the form-based code, for example, like how close to the street should we build things and create a more walkable and friendly environment, less emphasis on places to park. It seems like they had that all correct in the 19th century when a lot of these Victorian homes and Victorian streets were going up, and something that we got away from in perhaps the middle of the 20th century to the present time. So what we're seeing, even when we lose historic buildings, and I'm looking at Newport now, because there have been some high-profile demolitions of some historic structures. I'm thinking of the old school on 4th Street, which came down just, a year and a half ago.
Less than that, yeah.
And one of those, I should say, typical-looking modern apartment buildings is going to be plopped there in its place. But it's going to be built with access to sidewalks. So how do you find that balance? How do you figure out, well, we can sacrifice this historic structure as long as we build something on it that is conducive to the environment, something that is conducive to pedestrian access, and something that helps, like you said, feel good about our environment.
Yeah. From where I sit, the first choice is to really seriously look at what you can do with the building that's there, because there's a lot of investment in it, in the energy to make the bricks and in the character. They don't need to come back exactly as a historic building in all cases. Some do. I would say Memorial Hall, Music Hall, Union Terminal. Mm-hmm. Very precise restoration. But other than that, we need to keep reinventing the city and find ways to carry the value that's in the buildings forward for new uses. And that can be very creative.
Is a building ever really gone? I mean, this is an argument that you see in front of like municipal urban design review boards or whatever they might be called from city to city, where a developer comes in and says, look, I've been through this building, it's unsalvageable. And then you'll have a preservationist stand up and say, oh, come on. What does it take for someone like you, Mark, to say, okay, this building's dead, let's pull the plug?
There are very few buildings that I have seen that are not savable. I mean, I've taken ones that have been abandoned for 15, 20 years and rehabbed them into beautiful homes and sold them. And it takes a lot for me to say something can't be saved. But, you know, as a general rule of thumb, you know, if a building is going to get torn down, which I hate that in every way, but something that goes back in there needs to be better than what was there, not just a surface lot. You know, I was kind of upset about seeing the school torn down in Newport. It wasn't that significant of a building. But what I think is going back in its place is going to add much more to the city of Newport in terms of the residents that are going to be there, the new businesses, and all that comes with that. And that alone is going to boost the rest of the city up.
Newport is a city that has historic preservationists within its city government. Covington has that. Cincinnati certainly has that. Why is it important for cities to take that approach to, by law, protect some of these historic structures?
I think any major city that's thriving now in the country has taken historic preservation and kind of brought that into their overall economic development plan. I mean, it is integral to keep the existing fabric of our cities. It stabilizes the neighborhoods. We're working in Newport now to do another National Register Historic District with about 2,000 homes in it, which as soon as that's established, you know, we can have historic preservation tax credits come into play. People can start rehabbing, making it more affordable to rehab. And then after that, we're going to have our local district established, and we're actually expanding another local district. So as soon as that's done, your property values are starting to rise. It's building the tax base for this city. It's attracting people who are going to be spending money. It's creating jobs. There's just so many things that
give us the general idea, and we'll let you weigh in on this too, Paul, but give us the general idea of where that is. It's the west side of Newport, right, which has been a little slower to see the resurgence that the East Row or the riverfront in Newport has had.
Yeah. So it's 2,000 homes in the west side, more towards the Licking and a little bit south of the urban core. And with the new Route 9 expansion that just opened in the last few months, plus this new historic district, plus the new RIF development and big developments that are going on there, the west side of Newport is poised to just thrive. You know, it took probably 20, 25 years for the East Row to really get established and become what it is today. I think the west side is going to happen in 5 to 10.
I think the biggest threat to the west side of Newport is those new roundabouts. People have no idea what they're doing on those things. There's going to be some wayward vehicles going on.
It's not hard.
It's really not hard. It's really not hard.
I've seen people going backwards in them.
It's really quite a sight to see. But Paul.
If I could build on what Mark was saying, that's great examples of how historic districts are. But there's a lot of empirical evidence now that's been developed through economic research that shows that local historic districts, and those are the ones that have the teeth of zoning, the National Register is honorific, but the local districts increase property values at a higher rate than comparable districts. Donovan Ripkema, an economist in Washington who does a lot of work, has documented this. They go down less during recessions, and they increase at a greater rate. So.
And I think I've read somewhere it's like 15 to 20% property increase as soon as like a local district is established. Because, you know, if I'm going to rehab a house or I'm going to live here, I don't want somebody doing a really poor job rehabbing the place next to me, sticking vinyl windows and or tearing it down. So you're protecting your investment and it's just raising the bar.
And some people in some parts of these urban cities do get concerned when words like historic preservation overlay zone starts to be bantered about where they live or where they might own property. Because of what you just said, Mark, that means suddenly the government's all up in the decision on what windows can go in, on what colors maybe that the structure can be painted, what type of materials can be used in any type of additions, whether an addition can happen at all.
There's a need for education on that because it's the government is all up in their neighbors on that too, and so they're not going to be doing things. So if there's a coherent character to a neighborhood, it's going to be there. The Dayton Street Historic District expired because our organization helped create it in the 60s with a 50-year time limit because they weren't sure. So we had to renew it.
You're talking about in the west end of Cincinnati.
Yeah, Dayton Street in Cincinnati. They it expired. And so when it was renewed, we were a little worried because of exactly what you're saying. People came forward and said, why isn't my house in it? We expanded the district by about three times because everybody said, our house is historic. You know, we'd like to be in it.
All right, Mark, give me about 30, 45 seconds explanation of or introduction for somebody who's like, you know what, I've read a lot about these guys who take over these properties and do good things with them. I want to try it. What should they do if they want to get into the redevelopment of some of these old abandoned buildings?
Well, first of all, it's not for everybody. It's a tough business. But I think just educate yourself well on the historic structure and really plan out a rehab. There are so many people that just watch HGTV and think, oh, I can do this. I can flip a house in 3 months. And it's just, you can't do that.
Maybe they should call a developer instead.
Yeah, call a developer, call a historic architect, and then have them assess it before you buy it.
Paul Moeller from the Cincinnati Preservation Association and Mark Ramler from Newport and Mansion Hill Properties. We appreciate you both coming on and chatting with us about it.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.